America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. I almost said welcome back to, but guess what? It's the first episode. As the tagline says, we're going to interview the famous, the Atlanta famous, the infamous, and just folks that I find interesting. What does this mean? This means that we're going to talk to a lot of people in Atlanta, and maybe you've heard of them, maybe you haven't, and maybe sometimes the conversations won't even necessarily be about Atlanta. But a lot of times that's obviously the basis for how I know these people or how they came to be, and we'll start digging in, and it's just going to go where it goes. So I really hope you enjoy it. I've been doing other podcasts for years that you may or may not have heard of. We'll probably get into that in a later episode, but for now, I don't like to fuck around. Let's just get into it. Episode number one, Chef Kevin Gillespie, away we go. Let's start with what you were just, we were just talking about, the cool shirts and stuff. So what kind of music did you listen to growing up?
Growing up, like punk rock, heavy metal. Like, it's not even growing up. Like, I still listen to punk rock and heavy metal. So that's totally, I just grew up in that scene, like, where I went to a public school south of Atlanta where every kid listened to either rap or country music. And I was definitely one of those kids who just didn't want to fit in any way. So I had a lot of older cousins and started to go to Bad Religion shows and things like that, and as a kid,
would you
awesome.
Get right in the pit, or would you watch?
Oh, totally!
Resistance?
No. I've always been like a right in the middle of it. Like, let's just see how this works out.
So you've left some blood on the masquerade
for
floor,
sure, for sure. Yeah, I have a tooth on the bottom left hand side that's never quite. It's still a little wiggly and always has been for years because I got nailed the mouth one night at God, what was that place? The Neutron Bomb, which was over here somewhere off of DeKalb Ave. So, yeah.
And what you, just to give us some like context, what year did you graduate?
I graduated 2001 from high school.
Oh, my God. You were far younger than me than I thought. So, what school was it?
Henry County High School.
And the fighting what? What were you guys?
We were the War Hawks.
The War Hogs?
Hawks, like the bird. Yeah. War Hawk. Black and gold.
So I grew up in Cobb County.
Okay.
Which is you know, white and suburban
sure.
as you could be. And I honestly, like, I feel like my kids are getting so much of a experience of life more than I had. I didn't ever meet anybody that didn't look like me until I was in my mid-20s.
Right. I mean, that happened to a certain degree where I'm from. I mean, my high school was predominantly African-American. But, like, for example, I didn't meet the first person or – like the first Jewish person I knew until like I was in my mid-20s. Like, so like this just wasn't a thing.
Right. So like, so I grew up like, so total white boy land in Marietta.
Right.
And then all my friends went to UGA, more right. of the same.
Yep, exactly.
And then I moved to Boston when I was like 24 and it was like, oh, here's a real Irish person.
Right.
I'm serious. Like with an Irish accent.
Right. Exactly.
Here's a real Asian person.
Right.
And I didn't know that existed. So I kind of wanted to talk about you and your life somewhat, but I think we're going to kind of probably go all over the place because this is really about a lot about Atlanta. And so that's, you know, a lot, like so much has changed here.
Yes.
And what, you know, I always kind of like to explain to people, like, if you're not from here, like, we've been like trying to get legitimacy for so long.
Right.
And we always thought, like, people would say, like, no, we really have this and this and this. But I feel like it wasn't until, like, now.
Right.
That
Very
we have
recently.
That we have a real legit restaurant scene.
Right.
A real legit, like, the movie, I think, thing started it. Don't you think?
Sure. It's funny. Like, I grew up in the burbs. And then, like, the minute I turned 18, I was like, I'm out of here. And Atlanta at that time, like, there were some good restaurants, but they got no credit whatsoever. Like if you went outside of the perimeter of Atlanta for the most part, no one knew anything about your places. And I found that out really the first time when I moved to Oregon, like when I was in my early 20s, I just up and left and moved across the country. And I thought I had a really good resume because I had worked for Gunter Seeger and I'd worked at the dining room at the Ritz-Carlton. And then I got there and people were like, I have no idea who any of this is. and so I had to like start back over, like literally as a line cook, even though I was leaving as like, you know, a chef de cuisine in good restaurants in Atlanta. And people were like, who knows? This could be IHOP for all I know out there. And that was a little bit of a sobering experience to be like, okay, like I thought I was coming from a pretty big pond, but. And perhaps it is, but it must have like a fence around it because nobody knows how to
right?
get there.
Well, I'm trying to think even like what was popular even then down here.
So, I mean, at that time, like when I said I was going to be a chef, like I tried to go work for the best people. And so I went, you know, I went to the dining room at the Ritz-Carlton to work for Bruno Menard. I went and worked for Gunter Seeger. I worked for Michael Tuohy at Woodfire Grill. I opened 2 Urban Licks. Like those were big names, like in this scene at least.
Right.
And then you go somewhere else and nobody knew what right. the hell you were doing. And right. and when you told them I'm from Atlanta or I cooked in Atlanta or that's where I grew up, like there was always a very weird connotation of where you came from. I mean, people thought when you said I came from Atlanta that you meant I came from a trailer park in the middle of nowhere in the deep South. Like I think everybody thought that it was the like Dukes of Hazzard 24/7 down
right,
here.
Right.
Cause I got the craziest questions from kids. Like just, you know, going to a show, for example, I remember like my first day in Portland, I went to a punk rock show and these people just like, I got caught in the strangest conversations with people about like, oh man, it must be so weird growing up down there. And I'm like, no, it's not really that different. Like right. it rains less, I suppose, but like otherwise it's not that different.
Why did you pick Portland? Just because you literally wanted to go as far away.
Because I was like, yeah, here's Georgia on the map and here's Portland, Oregon, like as far away as I can possibly travel. And it was like either that or Seattle. And I went to both and preferred Portland. So I just stopped in Portland.
Because like, Portland was like even slower than Seattle.
Portland was more crusty, punk rocky, like DIY kind of feeling to me.
Portlandia.
Yeah. And I liked that. I liked that idea of like, Seattle's like a legit city, and right. I was like, no. Like I know, I've seen plenty of tall buildings. Like I want to live in a place where it feels like everybody is like, I do this for a living because I'm also in a band. Like, and that was basically Portland, Oregon.
Right. Do you play anything?
I played drums for a long time, like when I was younger. You know, when everybody thinks they're going to be in a band, but I just wanted to be somewhere that I felt like, I don't know, that I felt like was a little bit cooler, I guess, in my mind. And I don't know if it inevitably is cooler. I found out after living there for many years that it's just a collection of people who are not from Portland. Like, nobody's from Portland, apparently.
Right.
Everybody's just from somewhere else and has moved to Portland. And so it's a cool town, but eventually I was like, you know what? Honestly, you get a little bit of a context, and you're like, Atlanta's not that bad. Like, Atlanta's actually pretty great in a lot of ways. And so when I came back here in 2008, it was like getting in a time machine, though, because I came back and it didn't feel like a lot had changed as far as the food scene, the cultural scene. And then sometime 2008 to 2010, maybe, all of a sudden it changed, and it changed really fast. Like,
no, that's actually when I came back as well. So, and I, it's interesting, like, it, like, so I moved to Boston and then to LA. And I always knew I wanted to come back here. I just didn't know when, because those places didn't feel like home. Like, this always felt like home. And then when I got back here, I feel the same way. Like, wow, like, Monica Kaufman is still in the news.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, all the same people, like, that were here when I left are still here. Yeah.
Right. But then, yeah, this thing happened. And I mean, as I'm doing these interviews about Atlanta, I want to talk to people who are more into the –
Looking, I see the FedEx person out front here. They're probably going to try to deliver me some very random item. So
that's fine. to talk about the socioeconomic stuff, but it feels like the movie thing did kind of kick it off. Like it feels like, and I thought Atlanta was going to be just like every other like mini Hollywood that got the tax break over the years. So Austin was one of them. Seattle was one
right,
of them.
Right.
Toronto was one of them.
Right.
And I was like, okay, now we're getting art. But then they started fucking building studios here.
Right. Yeah.
And
exactly.
Now we're like this actual place where if you're a camera guy, you can work for a living. If you're an actor or an actress, you can work for a living.
Right, exactly. It's different. And I, you know, I never have thought whether or not the movie industry kicked it off. I'll take that, but I'll also say that I think it's one other piece, and at least in my industry. I've seen this in a couple other towns around the United States. All of a sudden, people started wanting to actually come back to their hometown. Like, a lot of folks, I think, especially in my field, like, you had to go to New York, you had to go to Chicago, you had to go somewhere like that, and a lot
France.
Of these kids did, right. But they all started wanting to come home. And so anytime you see that, anytime you see like a group of talented individuals come back to the place that they're from, all of a sudden something interesting happens. I mean, if you relate it to the music scene, it's like how somehow or another there's a really amazing music scene in Omaha, Nebraska. Like,
right.
How is that possible? Well,
right.
Because these kids just decided, you know what, I can make great music here. I don't have to live in Seattle to do it. Like, and so I think that we started seeing just a cultural change, add into that the fact that then the lens of the world started to focus on Atlanta because you had these big productions going on down here. And that mix is like, that's the fusion component where all of a sudden it starts to work. Because you could have one or the other and still nobody know what was going on. Because there's, frankly, plenty of really bad restaurants in Hollywood too. So it's like, you know, it doesn't just take movie stars to make a great cultural scene. I think it takes a mix of homegrown talent or talent that wants to live there and the energy and money and catalyst of economic trade that's taking place because of, you know, the airport and the movies and
right.
big companies relocating here and all
right.
that kind of stuff. It's a good time.
And since there wasn't TV chefs back
right.
then, what was your, like, so what was your sort of, like, hey, I want it. This really is my thing. Like, cooking is going to be the...
Well, I mean, it was honestly growing up in a family that, like, was very food-centric. My grandmother was the only one who cooked. Like, we all lived... Basically, my parents lived on this road that all of my father's siblings also bought land and lived on, and my grandparents lived on. So it was like sort of like living in a compound.
Was the name of the street like Gillespie Road?
It was actually Sunshine Circle, which was named by one of my aunts. Like, they asked us what we wanted it to be named, and we were supposed to have like a family meeting to come up with a name, and she just submitted the name Sunshine Circle before any of us talked, and we ended up with that, which sounds like a fake address, because my address growing up as a child was 111 Sunshine Circle.
No, it wasn't. No way.
Yeah, people were like,
Anytown, USA.
That's not real. Like, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so growing up like that, my grandmother's such a good cook that she just cooked all the meals every day for everybody. So we ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner at my grandmother's house every day, and so did all of my, like, cousins and all of the people in my family. And so you grow up watching this one person who seemingly has this superpower because they feed everybody. And as a kid, like, that gets a little mixed up in your head, and you think to yourself, like, so that's the reason everybody does what she tells them to do? Like, you know, I didn't realize, like, there's a lot more to it than that. But as a kid, I just, like, equated it to, if you know how to cook, you get to be in charge. And I have always, like, I've never been very good at doing what I'm told. I've always been a, I'll do what I want to do or tell you what to do kind of person. So I took that and went, okay, I guess that means I'm going to cook. Like,
so
that.
Your folks didn't cook. It was all grandma.
No. Yeah, exactly. Like, my mom can cook. She doesn't like to cook. My dad is really good at doing barbecue, but as are all of his brothers. And
like any real man should.
Right. Yeah. Like, that's all. Like, my dad and his brothers do great barbecue. They don't really cook anything else. And so, yeah, pretty much you just have this one person. And then my mom's mother was a very, very good cook as well. But she was more of like the worldly gourmand. Like, she traveled and – hold on a second. It looks like somebody's got to deliver something to me.
Sorry, I can pause real quick. No worries.
Only vaguely.
No, like I said, like, they've got 1,000 other deliveries to make. And
right.
So
right.
Do you – I know we're talking about your growing up, but do you – what do you start your day typically here, or this is just the day that you're
– So – coming from my home, this is the first one I get to.
So which part of town do you live in?
I live in Buckhead. I live like in, I call it fancy town.
How dare you?
I know, right?
You call yourself a real chef.
I know, my wife.
Living with the fancy people.
It's true. My wife is a very fancy attorney. And
Jesus, even worse.
And
you're like a heathen.
That's right. I know, exactly. And she got sick of having to live a long ways away from her firm because of just the crazy hours that they keep. So we moved a lot closer to where she works, and I'm like, I don't care. Well, I'll live wherever. It doesn't matter to me. So, Yep, I live in Fancy Town. So
and
when
kids or no kids?
No kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
Plan for kids or no kids?
Can't have kids.
Okay.
Found out we can't have kids. So we might. I mean, I think adoption's still on the table, but I think in between now and adoption will come the adoption of many more people who get paid every week by me. Like at this point, it feels like I have about 200 kids because we have so many employees amongst all the restaurants and the catering company and the events company and all that stuff. And I think under 25, we have well over 100, which is like having a ton of kids because they're always like breaking up with their significant other and needing money and
dating each other.
Yeah, and doing stupid stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. It's like having a bunch of kids.
Well, a lot of people can be good at what they do, right? Whether it's chef, plumber, whatever, but that growing a company, growing a brand.
It's hard.
Yeah. So, and obviously the more you're doing that, the less you might be actually cooking.
Right, for sure. No, absolutely. That's a direct translation. Like, I have to fight to find time to cook in the restaurants, which is probably shocking to people. But the reality is that I've spent decades at this point almost training people how to cook the food that I want, like the way that I want it done. And I've been lucky to have a lot of these guys who have been with me for a super long time. And so the easiest thing to turn over to them is the cooking. The running of the company is not so easy to turn over, though I tried my best. And I have some really good folks that work out of our corporate office that definitely help run this. But at the end of the day, like, I still have to say grace over a lot of things.
Well, how do you even decide? I'm sure you get a lot of offers from a lot of different things. How do you even decide what to say yes to and what's too much? Because the things you just mentioned,
right,
you know, a catering company and how many restaurants in Atlanta?
So we have three full service. We have a fourth that opens in August. And then
the one that I was at the other night?
No, a different one. So, yeah.
Okay, so plus sell merch. I mean, where do you?
I don't know. I honestly, some days I feel like I have no idea why or how we say yes to things. We just sort of go with it. It's very much in the beginning, it was a gut instinct. It was like anything that we got excited about was what we said yes to. Now we're trying to be much more methodical, and you have to get excited. Like, that has to be the first thing. Like, is this something that sounds awesome and fun to do? But then it still has to check off a lot of boxes because we don't have an infinite amount of people and money and everything else to be able to just do everything that sounds cool. So we have to be kind of a little bit more governed now. We have some new projects that start that break ground, what already broken ground, but open next year, next calendar year in 2018. And so our dance card's pretty full right now. And so for new projects right now, we're pretty much having to say no to everything because even when they are great, we just will be stretching ourselves way too thin if we do that. For years, I tried to always run by this sort of same general loose principle, which was that a lot of folks before me have built restaurant groups that, in my opinion, compete against themselves. Like, they build a lot of things that maybe they have a certain feel, but they feel so similar to each other that I wonder whether or not they steal and cannibalize their own clientele. I've tried as best I can. I don't know if it's been successful or not, but have tried to build things that are very different from one another so that, you know, theoretically somebody could accidentally eat three meals a day with us and never have any idea that that all the restaurants were sort of in the same group. Like, it was always my goal to be able to service a much wider group of people, like that we wanted to be able to reach people from basically every walk of life and not in a single restaurant, because that's nearly impossible. But to say, you know, Gun Show might only be for a certain group of folks, but Revival's for a very different group of folks, and it gives us a much wider net. So that's sort of been our catalyst for growth is, are we missing somebody? Are we missing a type or a group of people here that we don't currently serve? And if so, then we try to grow something that we think is a little bit more fitting to them.
And if tastes are always changing, mm-hmm. how does one stay with or ahead of that curve?
That's an interesting one, and I think that I have mixed feelings on this. One is that tastes change because taste makers make changes, meaning that if the people who the community trusts to have, I guess, go like, that guy, he knows what he's doing, if he starts doing something different, then tastes change. That's one theory, and I hope that that means that it gives us a little bit of an ability to sort of go our own direction and people will continue to follow. the other side is that everybody changes. And so we built restaurants like Gun Show that are forever morphing. It doesn't serve the same food today that it served when it opened, and that's on purpose. It was always meant to change and evolve, and hopefully we just change and evolve along the course of what people still are interested in doing. And if we don't, then I guess we always have the ability to sort of right the ship. You know, it's not so much, this doesn't work, the food world doesn't work so much like a bunch of different roads. It works more like a really big ocean where paths are sort of undefined and you can kind of flow back and forth between a lot of them.
All right, so let's briefly discuss, for the folks who haven't been to your spots, so just quickly explain like what the fare is at each place.
So I'll start with the easiest and get to the most complicated. Communion is a cantina, so it serves Mexican street food, mostly tacos, though not all tacos. And it serves, you know, a mix of kind of traditional and gringo-esque fare. So, you know, we certainly have margaritas and Mexican beers and sangria and stuff like that. But then we also do, you know, carnitas the traditional way where they're cooked in a bath of pork lard, like the right way, in my opinion. So it's fun. It's all outdoors. It's semi-covered, but it's not temperature controlled, and it's open essentially from the first day of spring through till the first day of winter.
What part of town?
It's in Decatur.
Okay.
So then we have a Revival. Revival is traditional Southern cooking. And it's, when I say traditional, that obviously a lot of folks go, well, what does that mean? The easiest way I can describe it is imagine what your mom and grandmother would actually make at their house. That is what Revival makes. And so it doesn't try to church it up too much, despite the street that it's on. Yeah, it's on Church Street.
And its name is Revival.
Yeah, exactly. But it does try to be accurate to what I think most Southerners grew up eating. And so it's a hodgepodge of maybe old school Southern food all the way up into that 1950s homemaker style Southern food. And then yet we also try to incorporate some newness to it as well. But we try to always keep it in that vernacular that if you brought in your grandmother and she ate this, and she's from the South, she would go, yeah, that's, yeah, okay. Like, and it would make sense to her. It's inside an old farmhouse indicator, and so everything we do is really meant to symbolize and, for me, get as close as possible to representing the food that I grew up with and in an environment that I grew up with, and that's what it was modeled after. So, Gun Show is insane, and as the name might imply, Gun Show does not have any boundary to what style of food it makes. The only governing catalyst, I guess, as it were, for Gun Show when we first built it was you can only make something you're actually, that your heart is in. And the second you don't love a dish anymore, you have to change it. You have to use as much product as you possibly can from your local purveyors. And you have to, whatever it is that you make, you have to have some sort of reason for making it. So this sounds kind of vague, but for example, if today's the first day of summer, technically. So
21st, is it? No.
June 20th, I think. Yeah. Okay. So today, if somebody came in, because today's the first day of a new menu, and they said, you know what, I wanted to make a dish today because today is summer, like technically summer, and I want to embody summer by doing a dish that has tomatoes and cucumbers, and I want fresh herbs, and when I think of that, I think of lamb. Like, they could do anything they wanted to do so long as they were trying to put forth, I guess, you know, the best thing they could. And if tomorrow they go, you know, I'm just not feeling that dish anymore, then they change it. And so we've had everything all over the board. And what's cool is that the guys cooking here, each person creates two menu items themselves. So they conceptualize it, they order the product, they prep it, they cook it, and they serve it to the guests. And they don't necessarily have anything to do with the two dishes that the guy or gal next to them does. So depending on what style of food you prepare, we have everything. We've had, through the rotation of folks that have worked here, we've had everything from super traditional Vietnamese cuisine all the way to hyper modern American to classic Italian to traditional Southern to kind of everything in between.
If you're doing that often, though, you know, one of the things I assume that a restaurant needs is systems, processes,
right,
cost, keeping everything right, what right, it's supposed to cost.
Right.
How is that, if without all that, like, I love the concept. Right. It's awesome. I can come in here, I can get all this different stuff. But do you run up against that? If the chefs are just like, wee!
A little bit, you know? But simultaneously, these guys are all really talented. And so this dude might be using eggplant today, stops using eggplant on his dish. Somebody else goes, hey, there's eggplant now. I'm going to make so-and-so. And so people end up using the product one way or the other. We keep a fairly significant amount of spices and dry goods. That can get a little bit on the expensive side because we want to sort of have everything that we want available to us. But simultaneously, because they're constantly changing the dishes, they're actually pricing them pretty accordingly to the market. So rather than making a dish and saying, this chicken dish costs $17 and it costs $17 for the next 5 years because we've never bothered to recost it, they're recosting it basically every day. And so the market pricing of the menu changes literally every single day. So whatever something costs is what it costs, and it's and we stay on top of it pretty well.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about the Southern thing is that, you know, my buddy just went to, is it Colonnade?
Right, yeah, the Colonnade, yeah.
For Father's Day, and he said it's because they can get chicken livers or whatever. But to me, I don't find those places appealing because right. Colonnade or Mary Mac's, because it's like, yeah, you get this old food, but the whole place is that. Right. They haven't changed the menu or the decor in 50
right,
years.
Right.
And, like, that's just not appealing to me.
Right, right. No, I mean, that makes sense. Like, I don't love those places either, but it's mostly because I feel like they've fallen out of love with the food that they're making. Like, I think that that's one of the marquee differences between it and Revival is that we are technically cooking in the same vernacular. It's Southern cuisine in some form or another. The difference is that at Revival, there are no sacred cows. We're not married to menu items. They change when we want to change them. When we don't like making something, we just take it off the menu.
Do you think they're afraid that, like, if we put in new drapes,
yeah,
we're going to lose all
absolutely.
Of our customers?
Yes, they're 100% afraid of the fact that the Colonnade is known for making fried chicken, and if they just tomorrow just said, I'm sick of making fried chicken, yeah, they'd lose a lot of clientele, for sure. And, I mean, that's the reality of it. Like, we face the same thing at Revival. If I take fried chicken off the menu tomorrow, people are going to be very upset, but I think I've made a career of and a reputation to a certain degree for not being okay with just staying the same and constantly having to change. And so people have just learned in the years of watching me do what I do that we're never standing still. So I think they've just come to expect it.
Right. So this to me is sort of the heart of the whole thing. What's going on now in Atlanta? You know, interestingly enough, like that term revival, like if you every city every year, you could probably read an article about, we're making downtown great again.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We've never had a good downtown, no. But this Beltline is on to something.
Right.
Something's
right.
Definitely happening here.
Right.
But here's the billion-dollar question. So let's look at Krog Street Market. Mm-hmm. I work right over there, and it is...
Oh, the kitchen just came to life.
It is hipster apocalypse is yep. One of the things I've called, right? So all the food places are aiming towards those people. They have those trendy names, right?
Right.
They're all kind of trying to do the same thing, but with different foods.
Right.
Some of them I really like. But as tastes change, like, that's the thing. What are people going to stay in town? And if they leave town, are those things going to become just a
right.
bunch of chain restaurants?
Right, right.
Right. Like, and again, as a business owner, so you're here right on the edge of where it's coming.
Yep.
Here in Glenwood. Like, I don't know, are you afraid of that? What do you think? Are young people going to freaking stay here?
It's a good question. I don't think any of us know the answer for sure. My feeling, my gut instinct is that people are moving back into town, but they're doing something that Atlanta has always been really great at, and they're really doing it even better now, which is Atlanta doesn't have much of a downtown, but has great neighborhoods.
Right.
And so I think you're seeing even more clear lines drawn between the neighborhoods, not in an exclusatory way, but in the sense that if you're into so-and-so, this neighborhood is for you. And if you like blah, 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 you should live here. And I really like that. It's almost like when you're in Manhattan and you can wander from, you know, Little Italy to Chinatown to the financial district to, like, where there's just a real feel about certain areas of town. I love that about Atlanta. And so what I think you're going to see is that people are going to identify with one or the other or maybe multiples, and then they're going to build restaurants that fit that neighborhood in that neighborhood, and they're going to be a part of it. Like, we're not accidentally in Glenwood Park. My wife and I lived in this neighborhood for a very long time, and so that's why we chose here for Gun Show.
When there was nothing here, I'm guessing.
When it was nothing here. Yeah, exactly. We chose Decatur for Revival because, in my mind, there was no better location to build this place that was an homage to classic family dining and family values than Decatur, the epicenter of where people live when they want to live that life nowadays, you know? And so we've tried to be thoughtful of putting them in the places where we think whatever that place stands for, that same ethos surrounds it. And so I think that I don't think these kids are just going to up and leave and move out to the suburbs when they get 10 years older, but some will, and others will, the next generation of them will be here. And one of the great things about restaurants is this, a lot of folks will say this is a bad thing about restaurants, but I guess I have a different opinion, is that they do change, is that they don't last forever for the most part. Only a very select few are timeless enough to last the 25, 35 year mark. And I know that everyone will go, Kevin, you're an idiot for ever wanting your businesses to not last that long, but I don't always want them all to last that long. I like to watch things evolve and change. And, you know, something like Revival, I think Revival is a timeless concept and it likely will have a very long lifespan. Gun Show probably won't.
So how do you know, typically the partnership is a guy that loves and knows food, mm-hmm. some money people.
Right.
How the hell do they approach it with that, like, all right, let's try to get 5 years out of it.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know because
there's a lot of sunk costs
right.
in just building the
freaking
thing.
Right, sure. Yeah, I really have no idea because in my scenario, that person is one and the same. Like, I am the sole proprietor and owner of all of
ours. You
don't
have some group of money guys?
No, it's just me. So,
do people want to go into business with you?
Yeah, yeah, constantly. We get like people offer us money all the time, but we've intentionally
kept it
this way.
Are you a communist?
Not really. We've intentionally kept it this way because it's cleaner and easier for me to live and die by my own choices and mistakes when I don't want to have to be indebted to somebody else. Like, so I saved up my money. I built this restaurant. When this restaurant made money, I saved it up and I built Revival. When Revival made money, I saved it up and built Communion. Like, that's how we've just done it. So, and then I've just employed people who want to be part of this journey. And so that's basically it. I didn't have to go find these business people who just gave me stacks of cash. I actually like it better that way because I wasn't cavalier with the funds of, you know, to do this stuff. I did it in a smart way where if Gun Show closed tomorrow, Gun Show's already more than paid back its initial investment, and it's
I mean, that's
fine,
that's so awesome. But do you have other chef friends that think you're crazy?
Oh, they all think I'm crazy. To go back to something I said very early on, I've never been good at doing what everybody else does or following what everybody else says you should do. I just do what I want to do. And there are plenty of days when being the one guy on the line is terrifying. Lots of them, actually, generally right before the opening of something new, like we are right now, where it's very, very scary. But there's also a lot of days where it's pretty amazing to think to yourself, like, I very much control my own destiny here. And if the time comes that I fall out of love with doing this Gun Show thing, then we'll close it and we'll sell the stuff that still has some sort of residual value, and we'll all move on and we'll do something different with our lives. And that's okay. Like, I think everybody who works for me is very okay with that idea. I think we've collected a lot of like-minded people who love that idea of a new place and a new journey all the time.
Well, dude, you seem to have figured it out.
I don't know about that.
Well, because I'm thinking, again, as a business owner,
right?
I've done whatever I've wanted. There are people who can work for other people, and they're super successful.
Right.
Like, I have friends that make a nice paycheck, mm-hmm. and they're happy with it.
Right.
And they don't want to have their own thing.
Very much so.
And if something happens to that company, they can move on to the next thing.
Right.
I'm not one of those people.
Right.
But I've run into something where just doing my own thing somewhere has failed me. Like, it gets me to a certain point.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The
sure,
vision,
sure.
The excitement, the not being afraid to take chances.
Right.
But then this other part called hiring good people, having a good team, somewhere in there I've lost
It's
something.
Hard, man. And I'll be honest with you. Like, I don't have all the secrets. I never would say that I do. We have been very fortunate as a collective group to somehow or another lure in other people who seem to sync up with us, but not always. We've also had some bad hires. We've had some folks join the team that really weren't they weren't on the same train trying to go to the same destinations. And so it's a live and learn sort of scenario. I think that this is spoken like a true person who's never gone to business school and has no idea what they're doing. Somewhere along the line, somebody either told me this or I heard this or I absorbed it, that the thing that leads to success is like an unbridled amount of focus and passion. And so I spent a lot of years chasing success to not be successful. The success has only come since I stopped trying to chase success and I just started trying to do something that felt genuine and actually made me happy. Then we somehow managed to be successful behind
it. But that is the thing that everybody always says. Yeah. Do what you love and the money will follow. Right.
And I don't know that it's as simple as that. It's not as simple as that. I think what that's meant to imply is that if you're doing that, if you're following those ethos, you're more willing to and more capable of dealing with the hard times when they come because you have perspective. You know what, you're doing this for a reason. I'm doing it because I like what I'm doing. Just because it's hard now doesn't mean I don't still like what I'm doing. When you're just clamoring to make money and be successful, I think your attention turns really quick to anything else that looks like it could make you more money or make you more successful, and you lose focus really fast. Like a good example of this is during that downturn in 2008 when I had Woodfire Grill, every person I knew was trying to figure out how to make their restaurants less expensive, more approachable, all the things that they thought needed to happen because they were just going after the little bit of money that they saw that was left behind. Oh my God, all the money's gone. We have to scramble for it. And I didn't. We focused on now is a perfect time to get even better at what we do and focus even harder on doing something that we think is worth doing. And there'll always be room for people to want to try to be a part of something that's genuinely special. And I think we came out of it much more successful.
So you were still there in 08?
Yeah.
So can I tell you, this is not just because you're sitting here, that I had the, what did you call it? Just the, hey, let us surprise you with the meat of the day?
Yeah, just our tasting menu, yeah. So
like, honestly, one of the best meals I've ever had.
Thank you.
I'm not kidding. Like, my wife went there on a date. And here's the thing. We're not, like, uber foodies.
Right.
But if we're going to go on a date and spend real money,
right,
I want you to impress me.
Well, that's it. And that was always my idea, was like, there will always still be people trying to do that. And if we all just stop caring about quality and are just scrounging around to find whatever dollar might be laying on the ground, then we're letting people down. Like, and so we didn't do that, and we went a completely opposite direction, and everyone told us we were insane, and we came out of the recession in a much stronger place. And Gun Show, the next evolution after Woodfire Grill, was built because I was convinced that you didn't have to do the $5-6 million restaurant build out and make every piece of every wall look so cool, because people were going to come to, there was always room for a restaurant that cared about a one singular thing, which was amazing food. And they believed that if you made great food and you set it in front of people, then they would make a great experience for themselves by being there with someone they wanted to be there with and eating something they wanted to eat. And so we went a very different direction when everyone said, no, 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 you can't. Atlanta's too big now. Atlanta's too bustly. Atlanta's too cool. Like, too many people are paying attention to Atlanta. You can't just do something like that. And we said, nah, we're just going to do this instead. And it's worked really well.
Yeah, because I couldn't tell you 10 other places I ate at that year.
Right.
Because that's how good that food was.
Right.
And I forgot who even, like, because we were, like I said, if we're going to go on a date and spend real money, you got to kind of, like, blow my socks off.
Right, right.
Because, and usually that wasn't the case. Maybe, like, the appetizer was good, but the main sucked.
Right.
Or vice versa. Or maybe the food was decent and the service was not so great.
Right. And that's it. Is that, like, I think that's something that we've always focused on, is that understanding the realities of what it's like to spend your money to go out to dine. You know, that's the thing. Food is a necessity. We all need food to survive. Dining is not a necessity in any way whatsoever. Dining is purely for pleasure. And so understanding where that line in the sand is, and then the obligation that you have if you're in the business of providing people with a dining experience, it means more than simply giving them food. There's a lot of other sort of responsibilities that fall on your plate at that point. And then there are a lot of things that people have convinced themselves are important that, in my opinion, aren't particularly important. And so I think as a company, we have shunned all those things that we think are just superfluous and inevitably end up making places more expensive than they need to be, or more exclusory than they should be. and have said that we'll just focus on the values that we think are critically important.
So when you're hiring a chef or anyone, what are you looking for?
We hire almost entirely for personality. That sounds crazy, but I don't really care what your resume says. Like, I'll look at it. It's interesting to me to see why you've chosen to work where you have chosen to work. I take that more from I just find it interesting to learn more about you personally from that. I don't believe that just because you worked at a place that has a great reputation means that you are great. I also don't think that it means that just because you've worked at a place that I've never heard of doesn't mean that you're not a phenomenal cook or a wonderful server or a great manager. I just mostly am interested in people's journey, but we do the vast majority of our hiring, as dangerous as this sounds, off of an instinct on whether or not that person will complement our group of people and whether or not they're going to help us see something new. We very, very highly advocate diversity, and that sounds a little cliche because a lot of folks say that, but we don't just mean racial diversity. I mean that I want people who may look identical, like who you're like, God, those guys look like they could be brothers, but they come from two completely different paths in life, because I think that the only way we ever get any better is if we have a brand new, fresh set of eyes that doesn't agree with what we've been doing before, that sees something completely differently. I love it when we bring in someone and they go, why do you guys do it this way? Like, can I show you something? Like, I learned this at a different place. Like, we're always trying to surround ourselves with those kind of people. And so what you need is someone who has the personality that wants to be part of a collective, who doesn't care who gets credit. Like, that's a big piece. And it's probably easy for me to say, I'm sure a lot of people will say that because my name is always the one that's written in the paper, but I've never cared about that. Like, and I still don't. What I care about is that we are successful, and I don't really care which one of us gets credit for it. I think that we go a lot further when we have a group of people who knows that any contribution they make rises the tide of the ship, that we as a team go a lot further than me as an individual or that guy over there. And so we're trying to always find that personality.
Is there a deal breaker, like when you're sitting across from somebody that they say it or do it, and you're like, all right, that's definitely not going
to necessarily happen in the interview process, but there definitely is a deal breaker in working with us. Like, the thing that will get you fired faster than anything else is tardiness. I grew up in a military family, and I was raised to believe that if you can't be somewhere on time, then you're effectively saying to everybody else that you're more important than they are. And being that, as I just told you, that we believe that the team can only be successful if we're all trying to do the same thing simultaneously, when people can't bother to be somewhere at a time that we've told them to be there, it says to me that they don't believe in that much, much bigger picture. So,
but Kevin,
that's one of the
my
fastest
roommate
ones.
Lost my keys.
Right, right.
And
yeah.
Then there was traffic.
I actually had
and
somebody.
And then I had to go to my mom's right. Because she had my credit card.
Right. I had somebody show up 2.5 hours late to work one day because they got, quote, caught watching their favorite movie, Point Break.
Hey, what are you going to do?
Yeah, they were like, I was walking out the door and Point Break came on. And so I was like, yeah, so I had to. And I'm like, neat story.
So in the restaurant industry, where some would say, especially on the server side, well, mm-hmm. turnover is inevitable and your standards are too high.
Right.
What would you say to that?
I would just say to people that when everybody says that, I always say, well, then why do we have so many people who have worked for us for so long? Like, we're not, it can't be some just weird, mysterious thing that nobody can put their finger on. I think it's because we've built a culture that we genuinely try to be good to one another. And so people want to stay around. It's not that we haven't lost people, but we've lost them for the right reasons. We've lost people because they're continuing their journey, not because we failed them. At least I hope that's the case, you know?
Right.
And so I just think this idea that it's inevitable that people are going to leave and you're just going to have to constantly be looking for new folks is a really defeatist way of approaching this. Like, they think that because this – let me back up and say this. There are a lot of things that have traditionally been okay inside this industry that I just don't think are okay. I've never thought it was okay to be in a work environment where you were screamed at constantly. Never thought it was okay to be – somewhere where people disrespected one another all the time. I've never thought it was okay to work somewhere where people felt harassed or felt uncomfortable. Like, all of those things that are traditionally part of the restaurant business, they don't fly with us. Like, that's not how I want to come to work every day. And I don't want anybody to feel like they have to go somewhere that's confrontational all the time.
Well, I mean, you do that. Hang on, I'm going to go ahead and shut this down, this part down. When you do that, when you do that and people want to be here.
Right.
I can't see it. Remember I told you I couldn't do two things at once? Finish. There we go. People do want their friends to be.
Right.
And people that they like and they trust, they want, they're like, they're not going to ask their shitty friends that they know show up late. They're going to ask their rock star friends like, hey, man, I started working here and it's great.
Right.
There's a term, and you didn't even use it, which is great because it's such a buzzword, and that's culture fit. Right.
Yeah, right.
That's a thing that's become a thing, and there are companies that excel at it.
Right.
And when you really take pride in it and you know that you can teach someone how to be better at their job, but you can't teach what you're talking about.
Right.
Do you read any business books or
no?
Do you
ever go? I should. I mean, I really should read more business stuff. I should attend more seminars.
Do you go to conferences?
I don't know.
Do you speak at conferences?
I do speak at conferences. Like, I attend them as a speaker,
right.
But not so much as an attendee, which is bad to say. But that really just comes down to the fact that I already have to travel so much that I'm like not looking for more occasions to have to leave.
What do you mostly travel for?
To do stuff like that. I still do a bunch of television work, and so I have to travel for that. And then we have a consulting company, and so we have to do like that keeps you on the road a lot, going from one town to the next to work on some project that's not in your home base of operations. So
if you're not tired of talking about it, can I ask you a couple of Top Chef questions?
Of course, yeah.
Because your season and the couple before and a couple after were the height of my Top Chef watching.
I'd like to think that our season really was the pinnacle. I mean, it's
completely... I've stopped watching, I can tell you.
Yeah, I have total partiality in this matter, but I do think that it was a great syncing up of really awesome personalities and really talented people.
And who won your year? Voltaggio, was it?
Michael Voltaggio.
Right.
Yeah.
And I honestly, when I did a quick look on Wikipedia before I came here, I was like, God, is it still on? How many people are still doing it?
It is still on. They're filming in Denver right now. I was just out there for that. So they're.
Yeah, do they have you as a special judge or something?
I can't say what I was out there
Jesus.
Doing, but but yeah, they're definitely still filming, and it's still very popular.
So. And are you tight with your alumni?
Some of them. You know, there's some folks that I don't really see much anymore. And honestly, a lot of that has to do with the way that the series works. Like, when a person is done, they literally do – well, they don't go home, but they get taken away. Like, it's like somebody's abducted. Like, it really is kind of creepy because they're with you one moment, and then they're not. And then you get back to the house, and all their shit is gone. And you're like, that's weird. It's only been an hour, and it's like they never existed.
Right.
Like, so depending on where they went off in the show, we might have only known each other for a couple weeks, you know? And so I still stay connected with Michael Voltaggio, Brian Voltaggio, Jennifer Carroll, Eli Kirst, like the people who were there towards the end.
Right.
We're still friends, but it's because we spent so much more time with each other than the folks who went away way earlier than that.
Right. Well, the reason I like the show and the reason I think it's so popular, because in our reality world, there's so much garbage, so much producer-driven, let's focus on the backstory. And here was a show that was really about how you did that week, period.
Right.
And they show you guys in the house a little bit, but very little of that.
Right.
And that's the reason it's been a decent show, because I can't watch any of that other
right.
garbage. But, you know, in terms of all that stuff, like, when you woke up every day, was it just like, all right, I'm going to see, like, whatever they throw at me, I'm just going to try to cook and see what happens? I mean, how hard was it to sort of just stay focused?
The cooking part's not particularly hard, honestly. The hard part is the mental component. The hard part is working through the exhaustion levels, first of all. Luckily, I don't sleep very much as is. Like, I never have. I'm not good at sleeping. So I can work on very small amounts of sleep and be fine. Other folks can't. The way the show is filmed is intentionally disruptive to you personally, so that you're constantly on edge. Battling through that mental challenge to have the clarity enough to cook well, that's the rub. And so for me, I just didn't give a shit about all the other stuff. I was just like, whatever, like, you want me to sleep here, I don't care, you want me to, I don't care, whatever. And then when the challenge would come in, rather than trying to overthink it or get inside your head too much, I would just go, what do you want? Okay, cool, I'll make that. Like, and it was just as simple as that. And my only governor that I had internally was, don't make something that you feel like you have to explain when you get back home. Don't make something that people go, dude, what was that all about? Like, always make something that you feel good about what you're making, that you like it. Now, if you make a mistake in the process, that's one thing. But, I mean, conceptualize something that you feel good about. And if you go home on a dish that you love, then who gives a shit? Like, then
and is
whatever.
That how you feel about not winning? You're just like, whatever. Like, I did the best I could.
Well, what happened to me, in my opinion, was that at the very end, most of the time people go home on the day that they crack mentally, like that they've had enough mentally. And that very much was the case for me. What most people don't know about is that I was going through a really terrible divorce through Top Chef. And when I left to film the finale was when my wife, like what happened was I literally went to the airport, and right before I got on the plane to fly out to film the finale, I got a text message that said, when you come home, me and all of my shit will be gone. Like, and Dude. That was it. Like, and so she just bailed on me.
Wow.
And because she was in a relationship with a server that worked for me at my restaurant at the
crushing
time.
Crushing me, dude. You're like,
and so I just had, I was just struggling mentally at that time. It was really hard to keep my focus. And that was basically it. Is that just in that, I just couldn't, I wasn't, that was not my A game in the finale. That was my B or C game. And so I'm not surprised that I didn't win at the very, very end. Cause I did do my best, but I did the best while working with with 60% or 70% of what I really normally could give, you know? So
is there part of you that thinks, how do we even compete anyway?
Right.
Like is Michael's food better than yours?
No,
right?
I just think they're very different. Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's sort of a weird thing.
You know, it's like, well, the thing about that show and about any cooking competition is that you're judging an incredibly subjective thing. It's not empirical in any way whatsoever. It's just, what do you like better, you know? It's like if there was an art competition show where people had to make a painting and you were like, that guy's painting's better. Like,
right.
There are things that you, if you know enough about doing it, you can grade technique and you can grade any number of other things. But making the assumption that technique is not where the flaw is, it comes down to which one do you think is better, and that's purely subjective.
You never gotten ahead of like, oh, like, what is he going to think of this? Or like,
no,
none of that mattered.
Don't care. Never have cared.
Anything.
And honestly, like, it clearly worked because I still hold the record for the most wins of anybody who's ever competed on that show.
Really?
So I won the most quick fires and the most elimination challenges of anyone by a lot.
And like, do you think that's where other people run into trouble?
Yes.
They think like Tom might not like
No, that's what I mean when I say people get in their head. They like overthink it. Like, it's not about that. Like, it's just they constantly worry about what somebody else is making instead of what they're making.
And do you have a relationship with any of those guys, Tom or any of those?
Oh,
guys?
Yeah, absolutely. Like Tom and Padma, like both, and Gail, and like, yeah, all those. I actually have made friends with them since the show, and it's been great, like honestly, because I've learned a lot about what they perceived of the work that we did when we were not in the room, you know, like how they saw our stuff. Like, and a lot of it, you get a better idea of why. Like, I know why I didn't win the finale. I told you that, but I mean, I know technically why. Like, what dish was a failure for me in the finale that caused me not to win? Like, so it's things like that are, you know, it's interesting to know that, you know? So.
All right. Well, I think we're good, man. What, anything you want to, like, tell people other than eating at your spots, any like socially where they can follow you?
Yeah, so
do you have a book you want to pump?
Well, you know, so I have two books out, Fire in My Belly and Pure Pork Awesomeness. We're working on a third book right now that doesn't have a release date, but I would say that keep your eyes peeled to my social media channels in the next 6 months or so for the announcement. You can follow me on Instagram at Chef Kevin Gillespie. Same for Facebook. Twitter is Top Chef Kevin because I've never bothered to change it since Top Chef.
Why bother at this point?
I know. At this point, I'm like, it's too many years. I'm just going to roll with that. And then we have our newest spot is going to be Game Changer, and that is opening in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, so the new Falcon Stadium in August. So come check us out. If you're at a game, come swing by and say hey.
But you're we'll probably, but I think, I feel like, like that's going to be one of those, like, I'm going to have to pay $27 for anything.
It's not that bad. I think our highest menu item is $15.
Okay. What am I going to get at Game Changer.
Mostly junk food. so, you know what? It's funny. Like it's things that we have sold at the various restaurants that have been. I don't know why this is. This says something about humanity that our most popular items we've ever sold are all things that are basically junk food. And so our closed on Sunday chicken sandwich, as we call it, which is a knockoff of a rather well-known chain.
Love it.
We think we do it a little bit better, but we do that. We do a smoked Kobe beef cheesesteak that's pretty rad. We'll have that. We do a buffalo pork belly dish that I created for the Falcons about 6 or 7 years ago that was their most popular like one-off menu item that they've ever had. So we decided to bring it back and do it again. It's buffalo wings made out of pork belly. And then we also do a rotating menu item called Devour the Competition that is based on whatever team we're playing. So
it'd be like Crush the Carolina Panthers.
Yeah, it'd be like if we're playing the Saints, maybe it's a muffaletta. If we're playing the Patriots, maybe we do a lobster roll or a spin on a lobster roll. It's things like that. It just gives us a chance to, again, we don't like doing the same thing all the time.
Are you a big sports fan?
Very much a huge sports fan, football specifically. So, yeah.
How did you feel about the Super Bowl?
It was not great. It was not great. I had an opportunity to dine with Matt and Sarah Ryan afterwards.
Like immediately afterwards?
A couple weeks later, yeah. So they've become friends of mine and my wife's, and we didn't talk about it. Let's just say that. So it's tough. It's still a very fresh wound.
Well, I said I was going to let you go, but you mentioned the stadium, which now, I mean, first of all, we could talk sports for 3 hours because I'm a football guy too.
Okay.
But I have to, like, I'm just curious what your thoughts are because like a big part of me loves and hates all of the change. Mm-hmm. So I live on the West End.
Right.
And they just put in all this concrete in the West End.
Right.
And I can literally run to my friend Clayton's house now in like 20 minutes. I'm a runner. But I kind of liked it when it was just dirt and mud.
Right, right.
And I'm not going to be a season ticket holder, but I'll be in that new stadium pretty soon. But part of it, I got to be honest, when I come over that hill, it's kind of a fucking monstrosity,
It's enormous.
It dwarfs the old dome.
I know, and I didn't like
it. And that kind of frightens me a little bit.
No, it's I was just driving from my parents' house this weekend. Like, I went to see my dad for Father's Day, and I was coming home, and I'm like, you hit that hill, where is that? Like University, and then all of a sudden you see that you see the skyline of Atlanta, and I never really if you looked for the dome before you could find it, but it didn't jump out at you.
Right.
And the new stadium, you're like, holy shit, what is that thing? Like, and yeah, it looks like a giant transformer.
Did they approach you, or did you approach them?
They approached us. Yeah, we had actually the Falcons ownership was pretty insistent that we do the stadium, and we at first said no, that we just. Wasn't really what we wanted to do. I love football and I love the idea, but we thought in the beginning that we weren't going to be able to control our own place, that it was just going to be a licensing type situation. Well, we were able to work out a deal where we run our own. So it's staffed
by you, their employees.
No, it's staffed by us, operated by us. So by our own terms. And so we worked out a really great opportunity with the Falcons and with AT&T because we're in their sort of section of the stadium to build something that's going to be pretty cool, I think.
And so every home game, and then is it also like concerts or only sometimes?
We will be there for every single event that stadium opens for. Like that
and
was
you
another
seem very proud of that.
That was another big caveat was that I was like, I don't want to be one of these guys who's like, we're there sometimes, but other times we're not. Like, no, if it's open, we're open. So that's
game
the deal.
Changer. It's going to be
called. Game Changer. Yeah, it's kind of a dickhead name, but. As is Gun Show and any number of other things, so I'm kind of good at that. So like that's just always been the way I do things.
Can we quickly mention how unsafe your footwear is for a restaurant industry?
So I'm wearing some flip flops right now. This is how you know I'm not working in the restaurant today. That's always their cue. Like if they see me in flip flops, they're like, "Oh, Kevin's not cooking." Like today is all meetings. Like. Which is my least favorite day of the week.
Other than this very pleasant conversation.
This is awesome. Like, I have no problem with this. But today is there's always one day a week at minimum. Sometimes there's more than one. Yuck. But there's at least one day every week that I spend the whole day just in a meeting for various and assorted things. Like, so it's all the unfun stuff that makes these things work. The P&L reports and the HR meeting,
Wait a minute. So you're not – so are you your own CFO?
No, we have a CFO.
Okay, that's good.
We have a COO as well.
Okay.
But I still have to sit in on the weekly, big picture meetings for all of these things. Well, I don't have to. I choose to. And then I try to hit each restaurant each day, but specifically Tuesday's a good day when I can talk to Joey. It's his first day of the week. And then go to Revival, which isn't open today, but the chef is almost always at Revival on Tuesday. She likes to do her inventory and stuff on a day that it's closed. And so I get, like, dedicated time with them to talk about their week and, you know, challenges last week, what's going on this week. And so Tuesday's usually a pretty busy day in that respect.
All right, so I'll ask you this, which is probably, like, the favorite child question. But, like, so if I have one meal to eat, if I'm going to take my wife somewhere, one of your spots this week, where should I go and what should I get?
I mean, I think if you only have one opportunity to dine with us, it's definitely Gun Show, because it is it's the flagship and it's the most representative of what I think a great restaurant should be, which is to say, no bullshit, just awesome food in a kind of crazy atmosphere that makes you. I think when you leave somebody's business, you should know more about them than when you got there. Not everywhere does that. A lot of places are just styled to the point where who knows who the owner is or what the owner even likes. That's definitely not the case when you leave here. You very much get a sense of who I am personally and what we're really into. So from the music that we play to the way that we decorate it, which is to say poorly, and to our focus on just the food being awesome.
Dude, thank you for doing this
with
me.
Yeah, of course, man. You're welcome.
Let's
Thanks
do
so
fun
much.
Social media pictures.
Let's do it.
And there we go. It's just that simple. That's what we're going to do every week, is bring you one of these conversations. Hope you liked that one. Hope you go to Kevin's spots. They're really good. Now, I'm going to tell you to do that thing that everybody tells you to do, which is do the iTunes review thing. More importantly, what you can do is tell a friend. So hop on Facebook. Hey, dude, found this new podcast. This guy, Matt. This one was pretty good. Can't wait for more episodes. Or maybe you'll do that after you've heard a few. Or hop on the Twitter and talk about it. Or whatever. Telling a friend, though, is usually how the podcast word gets spread. So I'd really appreciate it. Also, if you have an idea of someone I should be talking to, like, oh my God, I know this dude, and no one's heard of him, but you should talk to him because he's fucking fascinating, drop me a note. MattBDavis@iCloud.com. That's Matt, M-A-T-T, B Davis at iCloud.com. And we'll go from there. You can also find me on Facebook, blah, blah, blah. We'll get into all that later on down the line. I just wanted to keep this one quick, keep it simple, keep it clean. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next Monday. Unless I get bored, I want to tell you sooner. Thank you so much, guys. Talk to you soon.
Ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.